So we had a good 14-mile day. It's been good to discuss.
I'm not that bad.
Feel free to get up and close the windows if it gets too drafty. Otherwise, I'm gonna leave it open. Yeah, nice. It smells nice. Mm-hmm. I thought I'd leave it open. Welcome. My name's Jeremy Myers. I'll stand for now, but I guess I don't need to apologize. I might sit for a little bit. I always feel awkward standing for 10 people. I teach in the religion department at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. Anyone ever hear of that? Okay, great. Are you an Aussie?
No.
Oh, but you're. Thank you for clapping.
From Minnesota.
All right. Yeah, I'm just always surprised how many people don't know about Augsburg College, that there's an ELCA college in the heart of the city in Minneapolis. So I teach in the religion department there and oversee the youth and family ministry major, and was invited by these folks to come and talk about youth ministry, which is really exciting because I love this place and I love youth ministry, and I couldn't think of a better way to spend a couple of weeks. So thank you.
Thank you. Absolutely.
We've been working through this week a series. Some of you have been here. Who has not been to one of these sessions yet? Okay. It's a horror. I know. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It just helps me know how much background information I should give. We've been working through a series this week on what I call public youth ministry, or youth and public church. So let me explain what I mean by that. I am pretty darn convinced that there are two significant cultural shifts that have happened in history that have put us in the situation we're in regarding youth and religion. Okay, the first one really would be the privatization of religion in general. So post-Enlightenment, prior to the Enlightenment, one's religious beliefs, one's faith played a huge role in public discourse, in public discernment, decision-making. After the Enlightenment, that wasn't the case anymore. Religion was sort of sequestered to the private life, and in fact, most people thought eventually it would disappear, right? Religion sort of was thought of this thing that filled the gaps between what we really know and what we can't know. So a lot of people thought eventually religion would just disappear. But what did happen to it was it got shoved into the private life. By that, and now we know this so well, it's kind of the air we breathe, so it's hard to even imagine it being anything different. But this is where a lot of the Jesus and me kind of thinking comes from, that it's my own personal relationship with Jesus, and not that your personal relationship with Jesus isn't important, but that was it. That was the extent of it. If you believe Christ was your Savior, great, keep it to yourself, right? Believing that Jesus was your Savior would supposedly ensure heaven for you and had no other implications on your life. It was simply your personal belief in order to get to heaven, and it had no other implications on your public life. Okay? That's what happened to religion. And it's rather, that's rather new development in the history of the human race. The other piece, which is even more recent, is the emergence of adolescence as a unique life phase. It really wasn't until the early 1900s when this phase of life got labeled as something different. Prior to that, what did you have? Children and adult. And when did you move from childhood to adulthood? What would have determined that?
When you got married.
Okay, when you got married?
Childbearing.
When you could have children, which maybe would have gone along the same lines. When you could swing an axe. When you could clear the field, right? When you could work the horse and push the plow, right? When you could really contribute to the well-being of your family, then you were considered an adult. So really with the emergence of public schooling and the emergence of cities and industrialization, we created this new phase of life called adolescence. So I just like to point that out because we make assumptions as a society about young people, and we assume teens are the way they are just because that's the way teenagers are. Okay? And what I would like to say is, if we don't like what they are, the first thing we have to recognize is we're all guilty of creating this, right? We're all part of that. We're all part of creating this. So religion becomes this private thing. Also, adolescence emerges in the early 20th century, this idea of adolescence as a unique life phase. Religion is becoming more and more private with something that was called the Scopes Trial. If you've heard of the Scopes Trial, we won't go into that now. But that caused people to become even more private and kind of silent about their faith. So then our practices, of course, and the way our practices of Christian education with young people took on, were built upon these assumptions of private religion and these assumptions of adolescence, which I don't think we need to have those assumptions. Okay, so the assumptions of adolescence would be biological and cultural. So let me say a little bit about that first. The biological assumptions of adolescence would be that they're full of raging hormones, right? They're this makes them completely self-centered and anxious and worried only about themselves, and they don't really care about anyone else's well-being, and all they want to do is sleep and eat. Okay? That's sort of the biological. Are you saying, yeah, that's right on. the cultural understanding of adolescence would see a teenager as a lump of clay or a blank slate, just waiting to be shaped and molded, as if he or she doesn't have their own sense of agency, their own power, their own ability to resist culture, reject culture. We just think if they play a violent video game, the next thing they're going to do is, you know, become extremely violent, right? We never think of them as being critically thinking, compassionate, thoughtful, engaged citizens in our world. We don't think of teenagers that way. And so I guess my argument is that a lot of what we call teenage angst does not come from biology, but maybe more so from culture. It comes from a limit. We have set the bar so low that they respond to that low bar. And I think they become angry with the low bar. I think they want it higher. I think they know they're more capable. I think they know they have more gifts. I think they know they have more interests. And we just assume that they don't.
Jeremy, yes, could you just make a comment about how that is now extending?
Yes.
Into the 20s?
Yes.
Or maybe you're getting to that.
No, I wasn't, but I can make a comment.
You know, David Brooks,
absolutely,
now would add a whole other stage,
yep. Yep.
Or
yep.
Tweeners,
yep.
Or...
Yep.
Of Odyssey, I think.
Yep. And there's a psychologist named Jeffrey Arnett, and David Brooks has been writing about it lately, but there's a psychologist named Jeffrey Arnett who has written on a new life phase called emerging adulthood. So we've known in the field of child development, we've known for quite some time that adolescence has been expanding. A lot of people often say, adolescence begins in science and ends in culture. It begins with puberty, but we don't really know when it ends. Like, it's pretty, you know, if I were to say, when does adolescence start, everyone could sort of say, well, probably puberty, right? And the truth is, especially for young women, that age is getting younger and younger when puberty is beginning. But then they would say, on the other end of it, it just keeps getting later and later. It ends in culture. How do you know now when you're an adult? We used to say, well, when you move out of your parents' house, but everyone's moving back into their parents' houses now, right? Does that mean they're no longer an adult? Or there might be times where you still might feel childish, right? So does that mean you're an adult or a child, right?
Do you know that quip, you're only young once, but you can be on the tour forever?
There you go, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so if I had to somehow... Oh, this is all shit. If I had to somehow work all this, I would find my 9-year-old. Right? And my 9-year-old would figure it out. So who's the child? Who's the expert, right? Who's the expert and who's the adult, who's the child? So there's this concept now of emerging adulthood. So basically adolescence goes until 20, and emerging adulthood is 20s to early 30s maybe. And it's an interesting, and a lot of that has to do with people getting married later, jobs not being available, and so on and so forth. Really, you know, I'm going off on tangents, but they're interesting tangents. One can make the argument that youth culture as we know it really came out of the Depression. What happened with jobs when the Depression hit? Young people were working, right? Then the Depression hit, and what happened? They pulled the kids out of the jobs, right, so the men could have them. But now what do you do with all these kids? Compulsory education. We forced them all to go to high school, right? So that's really when youth culture began to grow. So the Bobby Soxers, was anyone in here ever a Bobby Soxer? Do you know what the Bobby Soxers are? That would have been the first youth culture, really, the Bobby Soxers. Because they were all in high school together. There was a shared music, a shared culture, a shared way of spending your free time. That was the first real youth culture. And the Depression really kind of fed that. So it will be interesting to see what this current economic, it'll be interesting 20 years, 30 years from now to look back on this economic downturn and how it affects this idea of emerging adulthood. So this is problematic. Okay, these two things, I think, makes it really difficult for people of faith to effectively proclaim good news in the lives of young people. So what I am arguing for is a switch from this biological, cultural understanding of adolescence to something I would call a vocational understanding of adolescence. So it's not just hormones or culture that's affecting a kid, but God's Spirit. We would say that God's Spirit's also doing something there, right? So when they're troubled, it might not just be hormones, it might actually be God's Spirit fussing with them, right? Disturbing them, messing with them, wrestling with their hearts and their minds. So if we truly believe, as God's people, if we truly believe God does that, when does God start doing that? After puberty? When they become an adult? When does God start doing that? And why can't we as a Christian community help our young people start to figure out what God might be doing in their lives? How God might be calling them to serve their neighbor? So that's a new understanding of adolescence that I think we need. And the second thing I say we need is this idea of public church. A community of faithful, well, here's my definition of public church or public youth ministry. An intergenerational faith community seeking to engage its context, all right? Its neighborhood. It's, right? It's you know, the 10 square blocks around the actual church building where, you know, most churches don't draw from the people who live in the 10 square blocks around the church building. So an intergenerational faith community seeking to engage its context and express its faith in public and constructive ways. We see public expressions of faith daily. Rarely are those constructive. They're usually divisive, and they're intended to be divisive. It's intended to do an us and them thing, right? We're the saved ones, you're not. Questions so far? So this is just some background. This is telling you why I think contemplation is so important, which we're moving to now. Within this idea of public youth ministry, I would say there's five art forms, and I use that term intentionally, based simply just to say, rather than saying practices or skills or tasks or programs, I think art form is more open-ended. It allows you to do it the way you're good at it. It allows me to do it the way I'm good at it. So how you go about accompaniment doesn't matter. You just need to figure out a way to do it based on the gifts in your community. How you go about living out a biblical imagination doesn't matter as long as you're doing it. So the first 3 days, this is what we were talking about, accompaniment, biblical imagination, and reflective practice. To summarize those three really quickly, accompaniment is engaging your context. How do you go out into the neighborhood, you know, with your eyes wide open, looking for what God's doing in that place? Rather than sitting in the church and opening the door and lighting the candles and hoping that people show up, how do you go out there looking for what God might already be doing in spite of God's church, and then call it good news? How do we go out looking for it? How do we, and not just go out, but how do we go out with a particular biblical framework, a biblical lens, you know, biblical glasses that help us reinterpret what's going on around us? And you've heard this. If you've been, if anyone just come in today, hey bud, you just came in today. If you didn't just come in today, if you've been here for Vespers, you've heard the people preaching at Vespers this week really doing this, engaging Holden's situation with the mine remediation, engaging that biblically to help us think about it more hopefully. And then we talked about a methodology of how you weave those two together through reflective practice, and now we're talking about contemplation. Which is good, because I'm sick of talking. And contemplation is the best way. So there's two words that come to my mind when I think of contemplation: listening and discernment. So if God is doing something in the world, how do we quiet ourselves, or maybe not even quiet ourselves, but how do we fine-tune the reception well enough that we can see and hear and discern what God's doing and what God's calling us to in the midst of the noise and chaos that we all live in on a daily basis. So that's where we're going today. So let me just use the Ezekiel text as a launching pad into this concept of contemplation. And I'll just read this to you. Then he brought me back to the entrance of the temple. There, water was flowing from below the threshold of the temple towards the east, for the temple faced east, and the water was flowing down from below the southern end, the south end of the threshold of the temple, south of the altar. You'll start to see that this image on the screen depicts this text. Then he brought me out by way of the north gate and led me round on the outside to the outer gate that faces towards the east, and the water was coming out on the south side. Going on eastward with a cord in his hand, the man measured 1,000 cubits and led me through the water, and it was ankle deep. You see, up to his ankles. Again, he measured 1,000 and led me through the water, and it was knee deep. Again, he measured 1,000 and led me through the water, and it was up to my waist. Again, he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not cross, for the water had risen. It was deep enough to swim in, a river that could not be crossed. And you can see his head just bobbing above the surface. He said to me, "Mortal, have you seen this?" Then he led me back along the bank of the river, almost to say, "Do you see how wide and deep and powerful the mercy of God is as it flows out of the temple? It doesn't stay in the temple and pool up, but God's grace and mercy and love flows out and becomes deeper and wider and more powerful. As I came back, I saw on the bank of the river a great many trees on one side and on the other. He said to me, "This water flows towards the eastern region and goes down into the Araba. And when it enters the sea of stagnant waters, the water will become fresh." So this idea of God's story intersecting and merging and flowing into our story and our lives and making things we think that are stagnant, making those things fresh and new. Wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live. And there will be very many fish, not just fish like us, very many fish. Once these waters reach there, it will become fresh and everything will live where the river goes. People will stand fishing beside the sea from En-Gedi to En-Eglaim. It will be a place for the spreading of nets. Its fish will be of a great many kinds. You've heard the joke, right? I know not everyone here is Lutheran, but there's the joke where guy dies, goes to heaven. Saint Peter takes him to asks him, "Well, what denomination are you?" "I'm Methodist." "Okay, I'll show you where the Methodists are." And he takes it down the hallway, and he goes by the Baptists, and he hears them clapping and shouting and singing. And then they go by the Catholics and he smells the incense. And then St. Peter turns to him and says, shh. And they tiptoe past the door. And the guy goes, well, why did we just tiptoe past that door? He said, it's the Lutherans. They think they're the only ones here. You can, you know, put in any denomination. Anyone you want to make fun of, you can put in. Its fish will be of a great many kinds, like the fish of the great sea, but its swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They are to be left for salt. On the banks, on both sides of the river, and this is the verse where we want to get to, on both sides of the river there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month, because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing. So why does God bless us? These trees are blessed with fruit and leaves. For what?
Food and healing.
Food and healing. So I want the way I want us to think about contemplation tonight is as something that holds these two together. Contemplation in and of itself can become evil. Contemplation otherwise can become a way of helping us understand how the gifts God's given us can be fruit for food and leaves for healing. Not just a pile of fruit and a pile of leaves, but fruit for food and leaves for healing. And the process of contemplation can be a way of us with our young people working through that and discerning that. So, quickly, what is contemplation? This is the image of the tree of life, which I love, and it's a nice image for me of contemplation because you see it sinking its roots down deep into the soil and sucking up life, but also sucking in life from the air, from the sun, and then producing fruit. It's this, give and take, back and forth, and I think of the practices of contemplation become practices that allow us to see that movement of life through us, from God into us, out to the world, from God into us, out to the world, just like the tree. So a nice definition of contemplation by Walter Burghardt would be a long, loving look at the real. It's not to close our eyes and breathe deeply and ignore reality. But it's to close our eyes and breathe deeply and take a long, loving look at what is really real. An ugly mind that's falling apart. A beautiful little girl dancing in worship. Right? To take a long, loving look at these things as gifts from God that make us alive. That produce fruit for food and leaves for healing. So contemplation becomes a way for God's people to discern to discern incarnation. Contemplation becomes a way for us to discern how God shows up in people's lives. Contemplation becomes a way for us to discern how God brings resurrection in the midst of death. Contemplation becomes a way for us to discern vocation or call. What am I to do, O Lord? Contemplation becomes a way for us to discern proclamation. How can I bring a message of good news to this person right now? A friend of mine talks about contemplation as listening to God while you're listening to another. So if I'm sitting here speaking with Paul, I'm listening to Paul while I'm listening to God. And I'm listening to God while I'm listening to Paul. So that I might begin to hear God's good word, God's good news for Paul in whatever the situation might be. Why is this important? 2006, the American Association of Pediatrics, or I might have gotten that group, the Academy of Pediatrics, American Association of Pediatrics.
Academy.
Thank you. Released a study. It was sort of a meta-analysis of multiple studies But they said at that time, young people, children and youth, were processing 3,000 advertisements per day. And that would be before the, you know, before the popularity of smartphones, right? So now, and even Facebook was around then, but it's just used so constantly now for communication by almost everyone, that we're actually processing more advertisements than this every day. T-shirts, radio, computer, whatever it might be. So why is this important? Because our lives are noisy. And the world's trying to convince us that it's more important for me to decide whether I should, you know, whether I should have it my way at Burger King or McDonald's. They find that to be a more important decision than how I actually should live an ethical, just life, right? So we get more help from society on decisions like that than we do on decisions that really matter. Society's just not there to help young people make the decisions that really matter. Okay. Why else is it important? Well, these guys are worried about the decreased polarization of society. But another reason why discernment is important is because of the increased polarization of society. Whether it be political or religious, it seems like right out of the gate, any issue is either a liberal issue or a conservative issue. And conversation ends before it even starts. Whatever it might be, it seems like conversation, like authentic, civil discourse, disagreeing, compromise, problem solving, just seems impossible. Right now, this is the view of a lot of us, especially the young people. They just look at religion and politics and say, what's the point? You can't get anything done. So, and the third reason, more of a theological reason why this is important, is there's a theological concept called the hiddenness of God. That God does never reveal God's self fully, but God reveals God's self to us behind things. Right, so God reveals God's self to us in bread and in wine or in water. God reveals God's self to us in the dancing small child, right? Or in the community that gathers at Holden Village. So God, in order to reveal God's self to us, God hides. If that makes sense. It's strange, but this is a one theological way in which we talk about how God reveals God's self to us in hidden ways, beneath things, behind things, within things. So that takes discernment. That takes contemplation to learn how to look for that. So what I would like to do with the rest of our time together is actually teach you a couple practices. And some of you might have experience with these, which is fine. Now you get a little bit of time to do this. Here in this space, but I want to teach you a couple of these practices. But before I do that, are there any thoughts on, any comments, questions?
Yeah. I work at a Jesuit Catholic high school, and we do during Lent and Advent, Advent and Lent, an Ignatian Examen, which is a form of a centering prayer.
Which we'll do next.
Which we'll do, yeah, okay. Great. But one of the questions we ask our adolescents, you know, it's a 5-minute exercise right after lunch, mm-hmm. is we ask them to reflect on the last 24 hours,
yep.
you know, and so that's a very concrete section of time, mm-hmm. and you may do the same similar
yep.
thing.
Absolutely.
And I'll have to say it's not the easiest thing for our students to sit through.
Right.
You know, they've gone halfway through their academic day, we're asking them to sit quietly and listen to mm-hmm. prompts for reflection. Mm-hmm. And it's not the most popular thing in the world, but I think the high school feels strongly enough about its purpose that we keep it there on a daily basis during those two seasons. It's interesting.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
There's a prof here from Concordia College earlier this summer, and he began every session like they are doing now at the college with is it a meditative moment, I think they called it?
Mindful
moment.
Sure.
Something like
mm-hmm.
that, just
mm-hmm.
as a way to try to begin the class in a more of a centered way.
More of a centering way, mm-hmm. sure.
Well, I think it's I mean, I agree with you completely, and it's important because contemplation is simplifying, is that it decomplexifies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it reduces things to labels or to stereotypes,
mm-hmm.
so as to create the us them.
Right, absolutely.
And so many times when you try to talk spiritually, I think it strikes many folks as just more complication,
mm-hmm.
more ads
mm-hmm.
coming at them.
Right. And there's a yes, absolutely. And there's this weird relationship with words and silence, right? So young people are suspicious of too many words because they hear them as ads, right? But simultaneously, we're pretty much convinced that we don't really want silence until we actually get it, and then we realize, you know, these mindfulness moments, how life-giving these can be. So, will any other thoughts or comments before we move on?
I do something a little bit similar. I'm a pastor, and I work with confirmation kids, and every time we meet, we start the class saying, having them talk about how they've seen the Holy Spirit present in their lives since we've met the last time. And many times it's, oh, they helped me, Holy Spirit helped me get my homework done.
Yep.
But it helps them to think about the Holy Spirit in daily life. So hopefully they're making connections even throughout the week.
Yeah.
They're seeing things happen in their life. I loved your descriptions, by the way. Those are great descriptions.
Thank you. Yeah, doing this really, I say, allows for two things. It does, one, it makes you do your homework. And by that I mean, so these students at your high school, or maybe even your confirmation students, they know they're going to be asked this question. And so what it will do is it will make them start to, you know, this is where I go back into my talk about biblical imagination. They start to reinterpret their own reality, right? So they start to think of things that they experience throughout the day as maybe possibly something that God's Spirit might be hidden within, right? So if that's what I mean by it forces you to do your homework. If they, oh, the pastor's going to ask us this question, I better be attentive today, right? I know, and that's what we want, right? We want everyone to be walking through this world in a way that's attentive to God's grace and mercy and human suffering. And the second thing it does is it gives us an opportunity to work things out with them theologically, right? So does the Holy Spirit help you get your homework done? Will God help you pass this test you didn't study for? You know, it gives us an opportunity to kind of work things out with them that maybe we wouldn't get in ways we wouldn't get to otherwise. So before we can do the awareness examine, we need to do centering prayer. Because contemplation essentially all grows out of this practice, which is quieting the mind and just sitting peacefully. So the way you do this, posture matters, okay? So feet flat on the floor. Posture matters because if you're like this, you might doze off, but your feet might fall asleep, or you just get uncomfortable, your hip starts hurting, that's me, and then I have to switch positions. So, you know, flat feet, straight back allows for better circulation, and palms can, you know, be flat on your knees, up, down, however you want, and just a nice straight spine. I am not... Anyone who knows me probably knows me well enough to know that I'm not naturally contemplative. I'm an extrovert. I will talk your ear off if you haven't figured that out. So this has become a really important practice for me because I can tell quickly when I'm talking too much. And so centering prayer is, there's no expectation to it really. It's simply resting and noticing your breath. And I think that's the simplest, I would say the simplest way to do this is to sit still, sit straight, rest your eyelids, and just notice your breaths. Mindfully notice your breaths coming in and out. For some people who have a hard time focusing, you might pick a specific word that's important to you, and you might use that word to keep bringing yourself back to prayer. So that word might be mercy. If you find yourself thinking about the hike you want to take tomorrow and all the things you need to get done when you get home, you might just start saying mercy, mercy, and that'll bring you back into this place. But why don't we just take a moment to practice this, just to see what it's like. Close your eyes, notice your breaths, and just breathe in and breathe out. This is not a prayer where you say anything. It's like crawling up into God's lap and resting in God's arms. And I'll bring us back together at the end. Allow yourself to just slowly come back to the room. Open your eyes when you're ready. Yeah, if you ever sense that message coming on your hard drive, you might want to enter Center in Prayer, right? What was that like? That was only 3.5 minutes. Did it feel long? Not long enough? Long? What was it like for you?
It's hard to stay focused. Like my mind kept wandering, and I'm like, wait a second, come on. back.
I like to use the words, when I breathe in, fill me, and when I breathe out, cleanse me. And that kind of helps me to keep focus. If I start drifting off, to just say those words again.
Yeah, and that's lovely to have words that also incorporate, you know, how you're embodying the prayer as well. Was anyone able to center and calm and experience some quietness? Yeah?
Well, I go to Jesuit, and so for our faith class, our teacher would have us every Friday do a 40 minutes of that, where we just sit still in the chapel. So I got really good at it, and so I make myself, like, just, like, my mind blank. Like, I would think of just, like, it's just, like, a word that I would pick every day, like, coming out of cloud. Like,
sure.
It would just make me just, like, calm down and sit there.
And did you find that, so 40 minutes, that's a long time. Do you find now that it's easier for you to sort of get to that center?
Yeah. It slowly got easier as time went on.
Mm-hmm. To the point, I've noticed that it can get for me sometimes to the point where I just need to, and I can sense when I'm disjointed, you know, and just anxious. You can just feel it in your chest, right? And I can take that deep breath and kind of go there, right, and be there. But it takes some discipline, some practice. But so this is high school.
Yeah.
And how do your peers react to that? Do they find it helpful or?
A lot fall asleep, or they'll kind of like open their eyes and like talk to each other, you know, but like they can't make any sounds, but like, yeah, so.
So they're not totally receptive to it.
No, it's hard, you know, I mean, it's like fifth period, so you're like after lunch, almost the end of the day, so it's very difficult.
It's difficult.
There's something about being silent with people,
right?
Too. That is, I think, both gift and challenge in some ways. We've been to Tisei a couple of times.
Sure.
And there is a 10-minute silence in each of the prayers three times a day. And the start of the week, it feels like an eternity, you know. And you can hear the shuffling, and people are restless. There's paper, you know, crinkling and stuff. But as the week goes on, been together, and you've done this three times a day, the silence gets deeper and deeper, more complete. Everybody is quiet, and I think the presence of all those people around you is
it's like they're all focusing with you.
It's very significant.
We would do the last church I served before I went back to grad school, we would do a winter prayer retreat, and it would just be huge chunks of time doing awareness examine and centering prayer, and this would be with high school students that were not required to do this. And I just got an email. These students would be 25 now, 27, and I just got an email from one of them who just went, you know, she just went on and on and on, and she was kind of this loud, boisterous, you know, just kind of bully, you know, she just was a steamroller, right? And she just went on and on about how those retreats, as she looks back on high school, got her through high school. That what we did in those retreats, what she learned on those retreats, got her through high school. And I get that, because I think I'm very similar to this young, the way she was. I'm very similar to that. And I am more attentive to my children and my wife, I think, this is what I mean by fruit for food and leaves for healing, right? That I enter centering prayer not so I feel better, but I enter centering prayer because it makes me more in tune, I would say, in my personal experience, to other people's needs. So this becomes a practice we do, not just with young people, but as Christian community, to learn so that when we stand up and walk away from 5 minutes or 40 minutes of it, we see more clearly our call to serve our neighbor. So centering prayer is one, and probably the most basic, but my favorite is the awareness examine, which we'll look at now. And this can be done with any age, absolutely any age. You can do this, and I've said it in another presentation that I used to do this with my son before my daughter was born and life got too crazy for me to actually be effective as a parent anymore. But with my son, when he was younger, I would do this with him at night. And just simple questions. Where were you most happy today? When were you most happy today? When were you most sad today? And the coolest thing was the night when I got up and from his bed and walked to his door and he said, "Hey, Dad, when were you most happy?" You know, and he's like 3 or 4 maybe. And I was like, "Oh, thank you, Jesus." That's fruit for food, right? So the awareness examine begins the way centering prayer does, by entering into this silence and listening. Really reflecting on two things. And again, I think it works best if you ask people to reflect on a particular chunk of time. So I would ask my son, when were you most happy today? Today. When were you the saddest? Today. And he can kind of think, oh yeah, well, we were having breakfast, and then we went to school, and we did this at school, and you know, so it's manageable. So you enter into silence, and you pray over the last day. And you ask yourself, what were the moments of consolation, the moments of grace, the moments of peace, the moments of healing? Then you also ask yourself, where were the moments, or when were the moments, where were the places of desolation, places of suffering, of fear, of anxiety, of death? And how else might we, a good exercise right now would be, how else might we ask those questions? If you've done anything in youth ministry, you've probably heard the term highs and lows, right? It's pretty common with young people. And I always challenge youth ministers to go this route. Just tweak your highs and lows this way. Rather than saying what's your high and low, ask them, you know, where have you experienced God's grace today? Where have you experienced rejection today? But how else can we ask these questions?
Well, you can ask the question, where Jesus seems closest to you, and where Jesus seems furthest away. So one of the ironies there is that sometimes Jesus feels closer in sadness and suffering. And,
absolutely.
You know, we get full of ourselves in the high times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we want them to be able to begin to reflect on those experiences in that way too, right? In hindsight, you know, you talk about peaks and valleys. In hindsight, a valley you might begin to see that the valley was actually a peak, you know, that this was actually a time of really important growth and very formative time in my life, and strangely enough, I'm grateful for it.
Yeah. At our high school, sometimes we ask the questions about conversations that students have had with their peers, you know, mm-hmm. which can be some of the most enlightening but also damaging mm-hmm. activities of that age group. And mm-hmm. so, you know, where was God present mm-hmm. in that relationship? How could you have conducted your discussion or conversation in a more constructive mm-hmm. or a positive way, mm-hmm. you know, so it deals with more of the interpersonal relationships. Mm-hmm. Too. Mm-hmm.
This became another nice way to use this. This became the assessment tool that we used for everything we did too in our youth ministry. We would, we take the retreat, we come back, we reflect on the retreat, we reflect on the last month, we reflect on worship, whatever it might be. The property committee at the church I was at. So one of the guys on the property committee was a volunteer with our youth ministry. He started to do this with the property committee as they started to make decisions about the property. Right? So it's just pretty neat how contemplation really becomes a meaningful way for God's people to discern and make decisions together and sort things out together. So in prayer, you reflect over the last, and we'll do this, we'll reflect over the last day, where, what were those moments of consolation for you, that moment of consolation or those moments of desolation for you? You know, I just came in the village, I got my lunch, and I turned around, and I don't know who to sit with. Mm-hmm. Middle schoolers are not the only ones who experience that, right? People experience that at Holden Village on a daily basis. And then at the end of the prayer, you just simply give thanks. Thank you, Lord, for showing me this, for teaching me this, for walking with me through these moments. And then if I'm doing this with a group, I'll ask that they share those moments. What were those moments of consolation and desolation? And we'll do a little bit of that if you're comfortable with it. Another way to do it is encourage them, if they're artistic, encourage them to express that through art. You know, they might want to paint or draw or write or dance or sculpt or act something out. You know, just more physical way of expressing those moments. So let's we have 5 minutes left. Let's enter into a couple moments of silence and just pray over your day, the last day, and act, you know, just asking God to reveal to you these moments of grace, these moments of challenge, these moments of consolation, these moments of desolation. As you're ready, simply return thanks and open your eyes and return to the group. So the question I have And I don't know that I have a solution to this, which is why I'm eager to have these conversations with you folks. How then might your awareness of these moments of consolation and desolation, how might your awareness of these moments become fruit for food and leaves for healing? How does this fruit of contemplation become fruit for food? How do these leaves of consolation and desolation become leaves for healing as we go about our life together now and then?
I think your comments of sense of awareness. So if I think about my day and the joy and maybe things that weren't as joyful, and I think, okay, if I'm in that experience, you know, experiential learning,
mm-hmm.
would I do that differently
mm-hmm.
the next time?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So being in tune too.
Sure.
Well, and I hope that as we become present to that in our own lives, and then you meet somebody who is venting a horrible day or exulting over a great gift,
mm-hmm.
that you have more availability
mm-hmm.
for them and more willingness to receive whatever that is and wherever it will go,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to stereotyping or
right, just shutting yourself off or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Possible or impossible? Is this something
essential
that can be done? Essential?
I mean, it gets us off automatic pilot. And finally,
yes.
I don't
yes.
think automatic pilot is much for healing.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
It also moves you beyond generalizing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so easy to say, I had a really bad day.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell
is
you.
Is that
where,
really
yeah.
all? You know,
yeah.
Or can you see gifts in the midst of
mm-hmm.
some difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I've never seen this before, but I went to the community library where my in-laws sort of had a week where they had different writers and poets in different parts of coffee shops around town, and you could go listen to them talk. And this poet was talking about, well, practices that you could engage in to spur creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this exact list, but it wasn't done as a religious activity.
Sure.
It was done as a poet. This is the process he goes through every day of sitting down and just kind of thinking of, you know, getting quiet and mindful and then journaling about what were the highs
mm-hmm.
and things that were good and things that were bad and things that bothered him. And that was the process they used, or he used, as we recommending others use as a poetry exercise.
Interesting.
And so when you were going through this, I was like, I've seen that before, but in a completely different context.
Interesting, yeah.
The challenge that I find with this is the balance between making this a very positive spiritual discipline and another assigned scheduled task that we have to complete.
Yeah.
You know, in a world where everything is scheduled and time,
right.
You know. And that's hard to find a way to make that happen.
Yeah. And yeah, and the only way it ever felt like a graceful thing for me was when I was doing it with other people. You know, when it's up to me to squeeze in 20 minutes in the morning, it doesn't happen, or I do it because I feel guilty about it. But when there's a group of people who I meet with weekly or monthly, and we do this together, then it's pure blessing. So this is one more way in which we can work with our young people to help them walk through their daily... And you know, I keep saying do this with our young people, but we all need this, right? This is not just for teens. I'm glad you guys are doing it. I think that's wonderful. But we need it too. And those of you who know how to do it need to teach us how to do it. So that we walk through the village with our eyes open more widely to what God's doing and to where God's people are suffering. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. The bell will ring in a few minutes for Vespers. Yep, thank you guys.